Okay, then I'm caught by the craving. What does the caughtness itself consist of? Can you reach out your finger and touch it? Is it a feeling? A thought? Check it out. You may find that the more you look for it, the more you can't find it, like chasing a rainbow. The caughtness that ruled your behavior so imperiously can't stand to be looked at and evaporates before your gaze. So then, you're caught up in fear of cancer, you're caught up in rage at your partner, you're caught up in eating that quart of ice cream, and you know you're not going to stop till it's gone, no matter how sick it makes you. Whatever it is, once again, break it down. Observe the process the way we just observed lust, broken down into components. Discriminate between one thing and another. See that thoughts are just thoughts. An image is just an image. Sensations, even very intense ones, are just sensations. So, when the forbidden fruit entices you, or the forbidding task frightens you, don't panic. If you do panic, notice that panic also is just a sensation. What does it feel like? Eventually, we find that nothing is overwhelming. The fact that you're observing the process of being caught means that at least part of you isn't caught. Breaking these things down also gives us more space to discriminate between feeling and thought. Often people say, I'm afraid of X, I'm angry about Y, or I'm despondent about Z. And while they might have had that actual feeling 5 minutes or 5 years ago, it has since passed, while the thoughts about the feeling and the situation that gave rise to it continue. In these cases, which are very common, being free of anger or fear or despondency is easy. It's just a matter of noticing that you already are. Thoughts are thoughts, feelings are feelings. It's all just thoughts and sensations, and they're all shifting and changing. What doesn't shift and change? You, the awareness that experiences it all. Just relax at the moment of contact and melt back into yourself, awareness. The sensations move through awareness like waves on the surface of the sea. The silent depths of the sea remain, as ever, undisturbed. Notice that. Thoughts are thoughts, feelings are feelings, being is being. This is the real Viveka. You stub your toe, you win the lottery, your favorite TV show is canceled, your book is optioned for a major motion picture, your toddler learns to hug you, that itchy patch is diagnosed as psoriasis. And what part of all that is you? That's right, none of it. That's all the observed, and you're the observer. Now, this is the place where people insist, often vehemently, wait, that's my toe and it hurts. That's my toddler and I love him. Don't tell me to be detached from them. But I'm not telling you that. Detachment is a word I never, ever use, as it's guaranteed to cause confusion. It's almost invariably interpreted to mean suppression of natural feelings. Don't suppress anything. Don't fixate on anything. Notice everything. Have every human experience, every human feeling. Sooner or later, you'll notice that all those experiences are phenomena, made of 100% thoughts and sensations. None of them can overwhelm you, because you are not a sensation or a thought, but that which experiences them all, non-phenomenal awareness. As soon as there's even one really clear moment of this noticing in your life, the root of fear, anxiety, anger, and addiction has been cut, and sooner or later they all must wither and die. If you want it to be sooner, sit regularly, and then, when you open your eyes and return to your daily routine, leave a little room for discrimination. You still experience everything, all phenomena, from A to Z. But what is it that's beyond and behind that whole alphabet? Don't try to see it, hear it, think it, or feel it. It's where you've been seeing, hearing, thinking, feeling from in every moment of your life. All the stuff is fleeting, impermanent. You're not stuff. Just notice. Chapter 27. Same Boat. You've heard the same blood-curdling scream in many different movies, possibly hundreds of them. It was originally voiced in a sound booth by actor-singer Sheb Woolley in 1951 and looped into the film Distant Drums as the death cry of a guy wading through the beautiful Florida Everglades who's suddenly pulled under by an alligator. 2 years later, it was recycled for The Charge at Feather River. A Private Wilhelm is sitting on his horse, filling his pipe, minding his own business, when he's suddenly felled by an arrow. Ever since, this sound cue has been known by film aficionados as the Wilhelm scream. It's a simple 1.5-second male scream, but there's something about it that's unimprovably hair-raising, as the final, desperate cry of a man suddenly caught in the jaws of violent death. At last count, it's been used in over 350 films, including Titanic, Transformers, the Star Wars series, Reservoir Dogs, and Kung Fu Panda. After more than 60 years, the Wilhelm scream has become a bit of a running in-joke among filmmakers and in droll YouTube compilations. But, different movies, same scream. Different plot lines, same pain. Different characters, same suffering. Maybe there's a clue for us here about how our own suffering works. When you really feel lost in fear, anxiety, or any other kind of affliction, it feels like you're in it all alone, as if you're the only person in the world struggling with this thing. You're locked inside your drug habit or your angry marriage or whatever cell you're in, and just to make your sentence even harder, your confinement is solitary. But this same one scream pouring out of hundreds of different mouths suggests that we're not alone after all. Perhaps we can loosen the bonds of our suffering by breaking free of the sense that we're suffering alone. As usual, the Tibetans have worked out the nuts and bolts of the methodology. In this case, with an ingenious type of meditative technique called Tonglen, sending and receiving, of which there are many different forms. Tonglen is a serious power tool that can cut through some serious pain by dropping all evasion and saying, bring it on. It's recommended only for people who are relatively stable emotionally and who have enough meditation practice under their belt to feel some familiarity with inner silence. If you don't feel ready, save this one for another time. We'll start with our core practice of natural meditation. As usual, sit comfortably, use breath or sound or any other on-ramp for a few minutes as desired, then rest naturally as awareness, marinating in the silent, spacious nature of your own being. After a while, bring to mind whichever affliction you want to address in this session, such as fear, anger, addictive craving, confusion, loneliness, grief, or despair. For this session, let's say you're dealing with despair. Naturally, the thought story of the circumstances connected with your despair is probably present. The loss of a loved one, living with a debilitating illness, losing the best job you'll ever have, coming to terms with infertility. Don't try to push the story away, but don't make it your primary focus. As we've seen, emotions are felt as sensations in the body. Let yourself feel the sensations of despair deeply, vividly, completely. Stay with that. For once, don't hold back. The sensations may stay the same or change. You may feel fairly placid behind the feelings, experiencing them from the place of untouched silence, or you may feel as if you're being pushed over an emotional waterfall. Whatever happens is perfect. Now, please consider that countless other beings have experienced exactly the same feeling of despair as you. Right now, and stretching thousands of years into the past and future, billions of others have stood where you now stand. How extraordinary! So many different people, in so many different lands and ages, families and walks of life, languages and religions and circumstances, yet the feeling is exactly the same. As you do that, notice the sense of the presence of all those other beings. You can imagine feel them before you and all around you, but actually this is more than an act of imagination. They're really out there. Palpably feel the bond, the connection created by the despair shared in common by all those beings, you among them. And now, in fact, take their despair upon yourself. Through your connectedness with all those innumerable wounded, despairing beings, let it all come to you. Open yourself to receive all the despair in the universe, drawing it away from the others and into your heart center, deep in the middle of your chest. You may feel strong fear or resistance to doing so, and that's fine. That fear is part of what you're working through. Imagine, feel that your heart center is surrounded by a hard, dry crust. This is the sense of being a separate, isolated self. As you draw all that immeasurable despair into your heart center, now let its intense energy crack open that hard crust. And now, out through the cracks, an intense, pure white light begins to shine, breaking through the crust like a chick breaking out of the egg. The crust is hard, but the light keeps breaking through till it all falls away. This is the light of pure beingness, awakening, healing, love, non-separateness. Let it radiate throughout your body, cleansing and healing you of all your despair. Then let it radiate out from you, out through all your pores, in all directions, into all of space, filling the universe, bathing and illuminating all beings, healing them of their despair and of everything else that needs healing. Finally, allow this visualization to dissolve and just rest in the awareness within which it's been taking place, the open, free, space-like awareness of your own being. As always, take plenty of time coming out. As with other techniques we've done, once you've practiced this Tonglen while sitting on the cushion, you can take it on the road. For example, if you're watching a performer on stage or a colleague, maybe even a rival, giving a presentation and failing miserably, embarrassingly, dying, as they say, you can do what we usually do in such circumstances, harden yourself, close yourself off from their misery. We do this, of course, because we've suffered some version of the same misery, or have imagined and dreaded it. We're reacting with fear rather than responding from love. We cringe, roll our eyes, and close ourselves to the performer's suffering because we intuitively know that we will otherwise feel it as our own. That strategy, the usual human strategy, has the upside of saving us from some temporary pain, but the downside of reinforcing our isolation. Our sense of ourself as a separate being, cut off from the universe and our fellow beings. So, if you're game, try the opposite strategy. Open yourself to the pain of the dying performer. Take it all away from him. Let it all flow to you. Let it burst open the hard shell of separateness around your heart. And out through the cracks, let the blinding light of illumination radiate, healing the performer, the audience, you, and all beings throughout the universe. This all happens on the inside, of course. On the outside, you can just smile and clap politely at the end. By the way, there's no noble sacrifice in what we're doing here, no cosmic martyrdom in taking the suffering of others upon ourselves. It's all part of our own program for living beyond suffering. We are actually sort of like people who tap into their neighbor's Wi-Fi networks. We're borrowing the suffering energy of others to free ourselves, selfishly using it to pierce the illusion of a separate self. And actually, even without our having any method or strategy at all, sometimes life will do this for us. There's a beautiful little throwaway scene early in the first Rocky film where our hero, frustrated with his life as a failed boxer and small-time thug, comes to the gym the day after a fight. There he has a testy exchange with an attendant, Mike, played by 5-foot-tall Jimmy Gambino. Mike: "You ought to take a rest." Rocky:
"No, my back is hurting."
Mike: "Your back?" Rocky, suddenly angry:
"My back is hurting, you deaf?"
Mike: "No, I'm short." There it is. Some of us are deaf, some of us are short, some are scared, some are depressed, some feel like failures. Everyone's got their problem, but no one's alone. Everyone's got their problem, so no one's alone. That includes all the people who you think have their acts together, unlike you. For different reasons, we're all in this same boat with the same scream. There's a wonderful brother sisterhood in this, which will melt our isolation if we let it. Chapter 28. Decide, begin, persist. Fear of making decisions, of choosing a path and getting on with one's life, is one of the most insidious forms of fear. Some people are stymied by one particular challenge, perhaps a fork in the career road or relationship road. For others, the problem is chronic. In either case, they feel stuck, paralyzed. Sylvia Plath captures the sense of this predicament in The Bell Jar. "I saw myself sitting in the crotch of this fig tree, starving to death, just because I couldn't make up my mind which of the figs I would choose. I wanted each and every one of them, but choosing one meant losing all the rest, and as I sat there, unable to decide, the figs began to wrinkle and go black, and one by one they plopped to the ground at my feet." For some people, it's even worse. They feel frozen by the prospect of potential dangers as well as delights, terrified that any fig they choose might contain a razor blade. It's as if, from the spot where you now stand, you can move in innumerable directions, each leading to unknowable rewards or disasters, which will land you in a new spot from which you can then move in innumerable directions. The more you think about it, the more dizzying it becomes. And there's the problem, the more you think about it. Can you reach out your hand and touch all those branching possibilities? You can't, because they exist only as thoughts. They have no substance. There's only one of those things that you'll actually do, only one possibility to which you'll give substance when you follow it out of this moment. And here's what people who are stuck don't understand. Thinking is usually involved in preparing to choose that branch, but the actual moment of choosing is a moment of dropping thought. Decide comes from the Latin decidere, to cut off. That is, to cut off the thinking process. You whip out your saber and in one instant, psh, 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 lop off all those proliferating branches but one. That doesn't mean the thoughts have to stop. We've learned that from meditation and from our practice of clapping our hands and dropping our thoughts. We just drop our engagement with them, and then it doesn't matter whether they go on or not. My high school Spanish teacher once said that if you want to drive a Spanish speaker crazy, You let him rant for several minutes about whatever's agitating him, then shrug, smile sweetly, and say, "No importa." It doesn't matter. At the moment of decision, that's how to treat the thoughts. And that's exactly what we've been practicing in our meditation, relaxing our grip on them, sinking back into the silence that always underlies them, and letting them go on or not go on without us. This doesn't mean we act impulsively. In the run-up to the decisive moment, extensive research, thought, and debate may well be called for. Being lazy about doing your homework rarely turns out well. But when that moment arrives, the way out of stagnation is to act decisively from that same silence we've learned to rest in. At the school where I used to teach, I sometimes sat in with the jazz band. I was a so-so saxophone player. One night after a concert in which our best players did some slick, out-there improvisation, the head of the music department, an old-fashioned European gentleman with a vaguely Franco-German accent, came up to congratulate us. He conducted the brass band, and his musical concerns focused on getting all the tubas to line up their oompahs in strict 4/4 time. "There's just one thing I don't understand," he said. "How do you know what to play?" Well, you don't know it by thinking. Again, there's thinking involved in the preparation, the whole jazz education of scales and rhythms. But the more you practice them, the less you think about them, and the more freely you can use them. I once asked the jazz band director what the secret of improvising was. He said, "You think of something, and then you don't play it." For the real masters of jazz, or anything else, it all flows from non-thought, from silence. Mike Nichols, the director of such brilliant films as The Graduate, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and Angels in America, started his career performing completely unscripted improv comedy, and he never lost its spirit. As he explained, "This is the thing that I carried into directing, not naming something, not deciding what to do. Being brave and going out empty is the only way, and it's both terrifying and thrilling." This is what makes all spontaneity exhilarating. The rabbit-out-of-a-hat surprises of great basketball, the careening riff of a stand-up comic working off the audience, the quiet flow of moments with a friend or lover with whom you don't have to weigh your words. Nothing snags. Everything pours forth from the place of silence that is the place of freedom. Riffing through life. Any life can be lived from that place. What if you're not a musician or a comedian, but an accountant? That's fine. The free-flowing quality of your actions may not be as obvious from the outside, but you feel it from the inside. The same easeful, frictionless action from freedom is possible no matter what path you walk. I've known Jay, as I'll call him here, since our 20s, when we both started off as penniless meditation teachers. At some point, he stumbled into the world of oil trading and found out he was good at it. Now he's semi-retired and works at home, trading only his own account. I've watched him at work, sitting in the quiet room that he calls the Batcave. With three big computer monitors on the desk in front of him and a laptop on his left. Tracking the price of oil, watching the curve creep incrementally across his screens, knowing that there are thousands of other traders, sharp, ruthless, simultaneously doing the same thing. They've all digested the same political, financial, geological, and meteorological information, and they're all breathing together in the silence, feeling out each other's minds, waiting for the moment just before the moment when everyone else clicks their mouse and the price dips or spikes. If you can click a millisecond before the others, you win. But you can't do it by thinking. You have to feel it. It's like being a samurai in a showdown and drawing your sword just as your opponent blinks. Once Jay went to the bathroom and came back to find out he'd lost $1 million. Unless you're a serious samurai, and have some serious cash reserves, it's true, you can't do that, get back up, and attack again. And every day, like the samurai of old, he prepares for battle by sitting in meditation. "It's not that I'm not scared," he says. "I am. But I know that everyone else is scared, and I'm coming from a place that's just a little bit below the fear, a little bit quieter. On a good day, that gives me the edge." Jay also collects art, and it works the same way. You learn as much as possible, think as much as necessary, then drop your thoughts and feel. Not feel as in emote, although that may happen too, but feel in the way the blind students I used to work with in college could feel the presence of a mailbox on the sidewalk, by the subtle cushion of air around it, and the way the traffic noise deflects around it. In finding art that winds up bringing him deepening enjoyment over the years, and, incidentally, increasing value, Jay has only one rule. Don't think. Whether you're recognizing an artwork or a turn in the market, he tells me, it's the same muscle. It's also that same muscle whether you teach school, or build houses, or coach soccer, or do massage therapy. When thoughts try to hijack the intuitive process, just relax your grip and drop them. You know how. Somewhere, in the deep silence of your feeling wisdom, the thing you're working on gets rejiggered and the right answer gets spontaneously spat out. But let's face it, sometimes the intuition muscle doesn't come through. In that case, the middle path is usually a good bet. When in doubt, pick door number two. But what about really hard choices? Life choices? The New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik describes the surprising advice he received from a professor in his college days. "Trying to decide whether to major in psychology or art history, I had gone to his office to see what he thought. He squinted and lowered his head. 'Is this a hard choice for you?' he demanded. 'Yes,' I cried. 'Oh,' he said, springing back up cheerfully, 'in that case, it doesn't matter. If it's a hard decision, then there's always lots to be said on both sides, so either choice is likely to be good in its way. Hard choices are always unimportant.' For people who are stuck, it can feel like they're on first base, agonizing over whether to steal second. 'What if I get thrown out? What if that loses us the game? I can't choose.' But not to choose is to choose. If you don't run to second, you've chosen to stay on first, and that might also lose the game. The word choose comes from a root meaning to taste. You ignore your clamoring thoughts, taste, feel, sense the totality of the moment, and then either run or don't. There's a Zen saying, if you walk, walk. If you sit, sit. Whatever you do, don't wobble. Once you decide, let it go. Either hold that stock or sell it. If you sell, you can keep checking the price every day and feeling bad about the money you're not making every time it goes up. Or if you hold, you can berate yourself every time it goes down. But would it help? I'm excited. So, decide and begin. If feelings of anxiety and thoughts of failure are there, they're there. They're just feelings and thoughts. By now you know how to disengage from the thoughts and just feel the sensations. Acting from silence doesn't mean trying to silence your anxiety. In fact, you can use your anxious feelings as fuel by reinterpreting them. Professor Allison Wood Brooks of Harvard Business School, realizing that anxiety and excitement are both arousal states, designed a study where subjects were plunged into anxiety-inducing situations, taking a math test, doing public speaking, or singing karaoke. The chosen tune, poor dears, was Don't Stop Believing. Just before starting, half of the subjects were instructed to say simply, "I'm excited." they did significantly better on all three tasks. They had the same experience of arousal-related physiological symptoms, the rapid heartbeat, the dry mouth, all our old fight-or-flight friends. All they needed to shift was their view. Hey, I'm just excited. Of course, with your cooler running engine tuned up by daily meditation, and helped perhaps by engine additives, such as occasional ujjayi breathing, you get less jerked around by arousal states in the first place. But when they do happen, I'm excited is a clever way to reframe them. But what about when you're overloaded with too much to do, and you find yourself rushing madly? That's a primo time to make mistakes, which then can cost you more time, not to mention money, misunderstanding, and heartache. How do you keep your balanced, cool approach when you're rushing? What you do is recognize the difference between rushing, which involves a grim, frantic, blind energy, and simply moving fast. Never rush, just move fast. Here's an experiment to point out the difference and fix it clearly in your mind and your muscle memory. First, do an exaggerated impersonation of someone rushing across the room. You'll find yourself putting your head down like a snorting bull and pumping your arms as you make your charge. Notice your emotional tone, which is probably also bull-like. Good. Now, do an exaggerated impersonation of someone strolling casually across the room with all the time in the world. You hold your head up high, regally. You're free to look around with ease and confidence, surveying your kingdom as you pass through it, seeing the big picture as well as small details, and perhaps even leaning back slightly while your servants, your legs, bear you along on your mobile throne. Notice your regal emotional tone. Now, repeat exactly that same regal stroll, but move your legs fast. Keep leaning back with royal dignity, owning everything you see. Let your servant legs do all the hustling for you. And now, consider how you can apply the same principles to other activities besides walking. Never rush, just move fast. Perseverance furthers. Once you decide and begin, keep going. Persist. Over the years, one of my major stumbling blocks as a writer has been that when I sit down and begin a new project, I find myself thinking, ugh, I'm writing shit. This project seemed like a good idea when I was just thinking about it, but now that I'm setting down words, I see it's shit. In the early days, I'd often get discouraged at that point and quit. But eventually, I started getting contracts and deadlines so that I had no choice. I had to keep going. I slowly learned that writing shit at the beginning is fine. You have to write your way through it to get to the good stuff. That's why God made the delete key. My friend Jody is a psychiatric social worker, and when I told her about my writing experiences, she immediately lit up. The same thing happens in my sessions, she said. I'll go through 45 minutes with a client thinking, this session is shit, we're getting nowhere. Then, in the last 5 minutes, the client opens up and it's gold. So, whatever your project is, assume up front that there will be stretches along the way, possibly long ones, where it will seem completely hopeless. Fine. That's when you find out whether you're an amateur, from Latin amator, lover, someone who does whatever they do only when it's a fun hobby that's easy to love, or a professional who keeps going when it sucks. As Hunter Thompson put it, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. The I Ching, or Book of Changes, one of China's classic wisdom texts, considers the cycles of human life and experience and analyzes them into 64 basic patterns, with advice for dealing with each one. But one admonition keeps recurring. No blame. Perseverance furthers. Don't get bogged down assigning blame to a situation or another person or yourself. Blame is lame. You can't move pedal to the metal forward if you keep staring at the rear view for the culprits that have supposedly held you back. Case in point, Django Reinhardt, the first great jazz guitarist and arguably the greatest of all time. His recordings with the Quintet du Hot Club de France in the 30s are some of the most joyously inventive music you'll ever hear. His solos sound like they're being played by a cool, happy angel with at least 12 or 14 flying fingers. But in fact, Django had only 8 fingers that worked. Early in his career, he was trapped in a fire in the gypsy caravan where he lived. Half of his body was burned. The doctors wanted to amputate his leg, and 2 fingers of his left hand were paralyzed. Slowly and painfully, he had to relearn how to play his instrument. There's some rare film footage online in which you can see him playing, his left hand darting up and down the fretboard, making all that sublime music with just 2 fingers and a thumb. Oh, and he spent much of the 40s dodging the Nazis, who were busy trying to exterminate all the gypsies in France. That's how you do it. Perseverance furthers. That's almost comically circular. Keeping going keeps things going. Moving on moves you on. But perhaps that circularity is the point. Life has its own momentum. The ocean of existence has its own tides and currents, and they move with a majestic wholeness and harmony. It's only when we imagine that we're an isolated little wave that we puzzle over our role in the ocean. Should I crest now? Am I too close to the wave ahead of me? Does this foam make my butt look big? The more we practice consciously letting go into that ocean, from which we've never been separate, the less we worry about deciding, beginning, or persisting. It's less and less a matter of I interacting with life. It's life flowing through all its own parts, including the bit formerly known as I. Godspeed. When people embark on a journey or a project, it's a nice old-fashioned tradition to wish them Godspeed. But as my friend Albert once pointed out to me, that means God's speed, not your speed. Things will unfold according to the big picture, not the little picture concocted by your little thoughts. You don't always need a definitive timetable or map. Here's a story a friend told me. Dave and I had been in a relationship for 2 years, and we could feel we were getting close to the crossroads where people commit or break up. There were so many things right about us together, but also a few big things that were wrong. I was truly torn, and so was he, and we were both becoming exhausted by the feeling of getting up every morning and stepping onto an emotional roller coaster. One day I was having lunch with a girlfriend, and she innocently asked, "So, what's happening with you and Dave?" In that moment, I felt the whole thing welling up inside me, and my voice caught in a sob. "I don't know." I think I shocked her. She became very quiet. But then I got very quiet, too, and very calm. I suddenly saw that it was what it was. In time, the right choice would become clear, and the future would be what it would be. Together or apart, Dave and I would be in the next moment, and then the one after that, and we'd both still be breathing. And that drained a lot of the drama out of it. I kind of looked around, shrugged my shoulders, and said, matter-of-factly, as if she had just asked me what time it was, "I don't know." Not knowing is fine, as long as you're fine with not knowing. As with so many things, the angst is not inherent in the situation. Much of it comes from knocking your head against the situation. But doesn't not knowing mean we're disoriented? Sure, disoriented, no longer facing east, free to go in new directions. Doesn't not knowing mean we're lost?
Sure.
But is that always a bad thing? Let's Get Lost is a cool jazz standard with some lovely, droll lyrics. Check out the Chet Baker version, especially the happy, relaxed way he invites us to defrost and to get crossed off other people's invitation lists. To defrost out of the old behaviors and expectations in which you've been frozen. To get crossed off the stale lists of who's who and what's what and if then. That might be really refreshing. As we've seen, most people have a lot of fixed ideas, whether they're about who they are and where they're going, or about politics, religion, or anything else. The thing about fixed ideas is that you can have as many as you like, but then you're stuck with them. They may make you feel strong, but they're really a sign of fear. They're like a heavy suit of armor in which you now have to trudge rigidly along, and which keeps new experiences from touching you. When we cast off the moorings of where we've been and what we thought we knew, we can set sail to discover the new world of what is. That's how it works, whether you're going on to the next relationship, the next job, or the next moment. If you're on a real journey, when you arrive at your destination, it will be a surprise. Somewhere midway, you must get lost to your old understandings. Disoriented, disemboweled, as my wife says, so that wherever you finally come out is a place you could not have conceived when you went in. Just say, huh? The more we take the notion of an individual driver out of the picture, the more we find that life drives itself. And actually, physics bears this out. Mechanical engineers who study the dynamics of bicycles talk about a phenomenon known as ghost riding. For reasons that are still not fully understood, all bicycles are essentially self-balancing. If you push one fast enough, it will just keep going and going. Whenever it starts to fall to one side or the other, it compensates by steering in the direction of the fall and straightens itself up. So when we learn to ride a bike, we're really learning to get quiet enough to feel the subtleties of its self-steering dynamics and get out of their way. Then we just cooperate and let steering happen. Everything, it turns out, is like that. The physics that steers the bike steers the universe. We're just along for the ride, rolling along on this bicycle of life, as free as open space. Ghost riders in the sky. J.D. Salinger says it a different way. He has his hero Sage, Seymour Glass, age 10, watching from a distance as his brother Buddy plays curb marbles on a quiet New York City street at twilight. After seeing him miss his shot repeatedly, Seymour finally says, "Can you try not aiming so much?" Chapter 29. The Buddy System. When I was about 4 or 5, growing up on Long Island, I saw on the local TV channel an old cartoon that left a deep impression. The Sunshine Makers dates from 1935, and it has that weird dream quality of many 30s cartoons, with their choruses of identical, rubbery-limbed creatures in perpetual motion, dancing and squawking to the accompaniment of a tinny orchestra. But this one tells a story that seemed to me like an ancient, mythic message. It's about a tribe of joyful forest gnomes who wake up each morning, happily worship the rising sun, and harvest its light with a giant magnifying lens. They distill it into milk bottles and then, like the milkmen of my childhood, deliver it to the doorsteps of the sleeping community. As they work, they sing in gnomish falsetto, and their song has echoed in my mind for over 50 years.
Sunshine, sunshine, I just love the good old golden sunshine.
Sunshine, sunshine, it's just the thing to keep you feeling fine.
Then we meet a second tribe, skinny, white-faced, black-haired, needle-nosed Marilyn Manson types in top hats, who live in a bleak land of dead trees, vultures, and a toxic pond crawling with vermin. They chant,
"We're happy when we're sad. We're always feeling bad. How are you?" "Terrible." "That's fine. We're happy when we're sad."
These agents of gloom attack the happy gnomes, and soon there's an all-out war, goths versus hippies. But the gnomes bombard the enemy with cannonades of bottled sunshine, miraculously turning them into creatures of joy, lit from within with sunshine, and transforming their wasteland into a paradisal garden. The cartoon ends with everyone dancing together in a climactic hoedown of love, singing, "And now the world is bright and fair, because there's sunshine everywhere." A few years ago, I discovered that The Sunshine Makers was on YouTube. Watching it again so many years later, I realized that all along it had been my mission statement. Here was my life's work, laid out for me in 7 minutes, to open up and let the sunshine in, and find ways to share it with others. Anyone who has tasted that sunshine can share it, and this doesn't have to take the form of teaching, per se. As you find yourself living more and more from the space of freedom, leaving your old fears and worries and stresses farther behind, the contrast between your own situation and that of people still mired in suffering becomes more poignant. As your own happiness grows steadier and therefore of less concern, you have more bandwidth available to concern yourself with the happiness of others. There's nothing especially noble or exalted about this. It's as natural as breathing in and out. In Judaism, this dedication to the happiness of others is called Tikkun Olam, healing the world. In Christianity, it's agape, or caritas, a word that is translated as both charity and love. For Muslims, it's rahma, usually translated as mercy, but derived from the word for womb. It's the nurturing love that recognizes all others as our children. For Buddhists, it's bodhicitta, enlightened mind, implying that opening to others is inherent in opening to enlightenment. As the Buddhist sage Shantideva advised, "One should always look straight at sentient beings, as if drinking them in with the eyes, thinking, relying on them alone, I shall attain Buddhahood." In AA, this equivalence of liberation and sharing is the 12th step, spiritual awakening and carrying the message. But again, carrying the message doesn't always mean teaching it or preaching it. We carry the message most powerfully by being it. You've probably met people who, just by walking into a room, make you feel happier, less confused, more loved and loving. To become one of those, now that's a worthwhile aspiration. And that's where you're headed. Every day we encounter people who are suffering, whether mildly or intensely. We may pass them in the street or nurse them through a crisis. Perhaps they've just gone through a breakup. They've just lost a loved one. They have an untreatable illness. They're worried about their finances. They're distraught about their kids. As they tell us their story, it's natural that we find ourselves searching for wise words. What can we say that will help them fear less, suffer less? That's a compassionate impulse, but sometimes words are beside the point. The search for words is an act of thinking. Deeper than thinking is feeling, and deeper than feeling is being. Often, the most skillful strategy and the greatest gift is to just be fully present for people, to be a wide open space of lovingly neutral listening, into which they can pour their story, or with which they can abide in silence as well. Be the therapy dog. You had some practice back in part one of being the sweetest dog in the world, and listening compassionately to your human self. You can also do that for others. Hear your friend the way that good dog hears, with complete ears-up attention and simple, unthinking love. As a therapy dog, you're not required to make sense of it. Sometimes all we hear is Radio Gaga, Radio Goo Goo, Radio Gaga. Just absorb the Gaga Goo Goo into the sky-like space of your own beingness, without trying to formulate understanding or speech. Don't worry. When something needs to be said, the words will be there in the moment, coming up from that peaceful, silent depth and conveying its power. Being there for others is what pulls together all your methods. There's a saying that to truly learn anything, you must teach it. That also applies to this kind of essentially silent teaching, this core deep reaching. By putting yourself into situations where your witness to the silence is required, at the sickbed, at the deathbed, on the phone with your sibling who's anxious about her health, at lunch with your colleague who's worried about being fired, you're called upon to use all your skills of awakening, from alert, upright posture to relaxed voice, to noticing the sensations so you're not overwhelmed by the intensity of the narrative. It doesn't mean you try to do half a dozen methods at once. It means that, in the crucible of the world where suffering beings need our help, all the apparently disparate methods are digested, integrated, incorporated, and seen to be just one method, and finally, no method. Methods just reveal what you most deeply are. Then you be that and drop all method. This approach of coming from silence is especially useful when the other person is babbling in confusion, ranting in anger, free associating in anxiety, wailing in grief. Don't try to stop your friend's tears. That outpouring of emotion doesn't need your words. It just needs to pour out. Let it pour, but don't be caught up in it yourself. As Maharishi used to say, when the cyclone hits, lie low. When your speech is required, often the most helpful and humble form it can take is questions rather than answers. But some questions work better than others. When someone is, say, grieving a death, friends will often call or visit and open with a warm, commiserative, "How are you?" Despite the sincere intention, this is usually too sweeping a question. A more skillful one is, "How are you today?" That brings things more down to earth, to the livable unit of one day at a time. Even better, if your friend is ready to hear it, is to live one moment at a time. That cuts through the notion that we're carrying our burden of suffering 24/7 without let-up. Sometimes opportunities arise for you to bring this to your friend's attention, the equivalent of clapping your hands together in front of their eyes. Drop it! And sometimes life does the clapping for us. One day, many years ago, I was standing on a sidewalk in downtown Elizabeth, New Jersey, with my friend Rick. That morning we had heard the news of some terrible incident of war or terrorism in which many children had been slaughtered. Rick couldn't comprehend what kind of world could let that happen to little children. And as we spoke about it, he began to cry. Just then, down the sidewalk on the other side of the street, smiling the warmest, most radiant smile imaginable, came walking, or rather gliding, one of the most astonishingly beautiful, astonishingly sexy women I, or believe me, anyone, had ever seen. We fell silent, and for a moment we were delivered from our world anguish by this goddess visitation. Then Rick looked at me and laughed sheepishly. Busted! You can say that we were crass, that our compassion was too shallow to withstand the first shapely distraction to come along, but I would argue that this was not merely a distraction, but a reprieve, one on the house, a gift that we would be wrong not to accept graciously, and then back to caring for the world. Miles Ahead. Herbie Hancock, the great jazz keyboardist, tells a story about a concert he played with Miles Davis in Stuttgart in the early 60s. They had a big, enthusiastic crowd. The whole ensemble consisted of top-flight musicians, and they were having a great night, clicking on all cylinders. Then, in the middle of playing So What, one of Miles's signature compositions, Herbie suddenly played a wrong chord. Not just a little bit wrong, but glaringly, unimaginably, catastrophically wrong. It was such a disaster that he stopped playing and clapped his hands to the sides of his head, frozen in horror. Then Miles did something extraordinary. Without missing a beat, literally, he played the notes that made Herbie's wrong chord right. He made it part of the tune, wove it in seamlessly, so that, instead of being an all-is-lost, kill-me-now debacle, the chord became a daring foray into way-out-there tonalities, opening an exciting new space for Miles and his trumpet to explore. So what, indeed. There's a lesson here in how to practice Rachma, Caritas, Tikkun Olam. Here we are. Someone, maybe another, maybe you, has screwed up. And now there's a calamity on our hands. This is the moment we're in. These are the chords that have been played. There are no do-overs. We have to, as they say in golf, play it as it lies. We might get so fixated on the calamitous nature of the situation that we're paralyzed, hands to the sides of our heads. We might rage against the perpetrator. If we're the perp ourselves and we're not true grown-ups, we might try to shift the blame to someone else. But blame is lame. Perseverance furthers. We persevere by playing the notes that make the wrong chords right. On a good day, when we handle things deftly, the disaster becomes an opportunity to expand our melodic range into new territory. This is what I love about Siri when she's performing her GPS function. She doesn't berate me for missing a turn. She just quietly reroutes my trip. And from where I am now, no matter how I got here, she takes me forward. If I can sit back and relax into my seat rather than berating myself, I can enjoy some new scenery. And by the way, everything that happens actually is part of the tune, the subtle tune of the universe, the harmony of the spheres. Playing the notes that make all the seemingly wrong stuff right is ultimately not a matter of inventing them, but of finding them, hearing them, and letting them play you. Buddies. Once in a while, you might find yourself in a situation where a friend is ripe for more than just help with the immediate acute crisis. They're ready to hear the teaching, to see the curtains part on the big picture of life, the sky-like space of unchanging, transcendent, silent okayness, ever untouched by the winds of change and always easily accessible just by resting as awareness. For at least that moment, they have ears to hear. No one can push them to that moment, just as no one could have pushed you to this one. That's why evangelizing doesn't work. But again, by being it rather than preaching it, you've become the example and the lighthouse. Over time, your friends will notice that you no longer get caught in fear or rage, dependency or despondency, and they'll ask why. Then you can explain things in simple terms and offer whatever resources, books, methods, teachers, you think they might connect with. Meanwhile, you can be sensitive, alert for the opening, for when and how this person will be able to hear. That's skillful compassion. If each one of us does that at least once, each one reach one, then eventually the light spreads to everyone. Then the world is bright and fair because there's sunshine everywhere. In practice, of course,